Welcome back to Two Halves Make a Whole. I'm Mike Cherney.
And I'm Aaron Blumenthal.
And we are here to bring you potentially useful financial news, tidbits, and some history.
Hopefully a little bit of history. So today we are going to be looking at a couple different things, ranging from, you know, the supplies of things, inflation, kind of a potpourri, if you will.
Yeah, and all of them kind of build on some of the last few topics that we talked about. So last time was about the FIRE strategies. We talked about hyperinflation, and we've talked about more or less just handling your money in general. And this week, we want to talk about how people perceive their money in terms of cash versus debt, how you leverage yourself. We'll get into that. How this kind of ties into those previous strategies that we talked through, and how it's influenced by things like inflation.
Yeah. So first and foremost, what is inflation? What is deflation, right? Everybody knows sort of historical examples of this. You know, historically, we look at Germany before World War II, during the Great Depression, and the United States actually at that same period of time for rampant inflation. There's stories of people that would have a basket full of cash, and by the end of the day, that cash was worthless to buy anything. So inflation means essentially your money has less power, right? Less buying power, yeah, correct. So suppose a loaf of bread in a theoretical universe costs $1, right? Inflation means that if we have hyperinflation that's on a daily scale, then that means at the end of the day, it could be $10 for a loaf of bread, right? It's your money buys less, and you can stretch it less far.
I got what you're saying.
That makes sense.
I do want to point out that we made it 1 minute and 15 seconds before the history came in, so that was good.
That's fair. But there are so much we can get into, including Argentina and Chile in the 1980s. With the Chicago School of Economics and economists, and how they went down there and did a bunch of things, which is super cool. I will not get into that. I'm lying. We'll definitely talk about that later at some point.
Another episode.
But deflation, on the other hand, is if that loaf of bread now instead costs 90 cents or 50 cents at the end of the day, if we're talking that deflation on a daily scale. So basically, your money stretches further.
Correct. So tying back to other topics we've had, if you go back to some of the cryptocurrency topics, Bitcoin is a deflationary asset and the US dollar is an inflationary asset. So the US dollar perpetually over time loses value because there's more money put into circulation because it's diluted, having more of it, so more supply for, we'll say, the same demand, the money is worth less. That's a really basic way of stating it, but it kind of gets the point across. With Bitcoin, you have the opposite. You have a fixed supply and the demand continues to rise. So if you look at just how supply and demand works, the more people that want that thing that there is a fixed amount of or less of over time, such as land, yeah. that it increases in value over time.
Like the classic textbook example of supply and demand, just to kind of also quickly talk about that, is umbrellas. On a rainy day, everybody wants an umbrella, and the number of umbrellas in the store is a fixed amount, right? They can't just suddenly pull new umbrellas out of nowhere, right? One day they will be able to do 3D printing, but that's a separate story. Maybe.
But in today's practices.
But in today's practices.
Well, actually, but...
So that was...
Real example, though. The umbrella example is obviously real, but... One that people are probably feeling, and I'll just go for my own example, right, that I'm feeling is car shopping. There's supposedly not that many of them. Now, I think the supply is starting to increase, but they're still playing the scarcity scheme. So the car prices, used values, new values are through the roof. There's dealers that are trying to gouge their customers to raise prices. So you're seeing some level of inflation happen, and that this is the scarcity, and because that supply is prices. Maybe our explanation doesn't work quite well.
Yes.
But the value of something versus the cost of something is kind of the dichotomy here, right? So you're looking at just because something costs more doesn't mean it has more value. So if your dollar looking at the cost of a vehicle, the value of the vehicle has gone up, but the cost of the vehicle has gone up, so the value of your dollar has gone down. So trying to buy that vehicle will now cost you more dollars. Same with Bitcoin. If you want to buy more Bitcoin, if you want to buy more land, the land or the Bitcoin continues to increase in value, and therefore your dollar in relation to it is worth less. The dollar is inflationary while those other assets are deflationary.
I'm going to stick with the umbrella example, though, for right now, for a whole host of reasons.
All right, let's hear it.
Okay, so it's a sunny day. Their supposed store has a ton of umbrellas, right? The umbrella, like, not so many people want to buy it right now, right? So the umbrella cost is, you know, no matter where it's set, it probably is too high. People aren't just going to buy it. On a rainy day, everybody wants an umbrella. But now, because there's a fixed number of umbrellas, the cost of that, in theory, now goes up, right?
Well, they can raise their price.
They can raise their price, exactly. Because someone's now willing to pay. Suppose it was on a sunny day, it's $1 to buy that's what the break-even cost is. Someone's willing on a rainy day to pay $5 or $10. So the cost of this umbrella is now theoretically going up, right? The utility, which is the willingness for a person to pay for something, has increased. The reason I like the umbrella example is, in theory, all the umbrellas are the same. And in theory, the price is going to be apparent. And it's obvious for all customers. They're able to see what that cost is.
A more efficient market, if you will.
Exactly. That's actually why this is like a super classic textbook example versus cars and houses. Because the issue is with cars and houses, due to the way that the markets are set up with dealers and with realtors, as a go-between, the customer doesn't have all the information, right? A good way of thinking about this is the difference between chess and poker. I know it seems completely out there, but hear me out. Chess, I can't hide where my pawns are. I'm not going to hide where my king is. All the information is set. It's now the best strategy based off of the information that everybody can see. While in poker, supposing you're playing, you know, Texas Hold'em, Omaha, or, seven-car stud, you have partial information, but you don't have all the information, right? And with a car or with a home, when you're purchasing those, you have partial information. I have the cost of what it costs to build. I can get certain information, but I don't have the information of what the other person is willing to sell it for, so to speak. And so that's why I'm going to push back on the house and the car, because there is a lot of confounding factors. But with those confounding factors, there is a certain amount of risk, and there's a bunch of other things that go into it. And these are actually more realistic situations, right? When you go out into the market, when you're looking at stocks, there's an amount of risk to it. And just like in poker, you don't know where the next card in the flop is going to go, right? So that's probably a better analogy for thinking about things, you know, instead of saying, hey, listen, this is, you know, I'm playing chess or checkers. No, if you're dealing with money, you're most likely playing poker. Like quite literally. I know that's like a weird digression, but
it is gambling. It is gambling on anything. You can buy that umbrella and it can be sunny right when you walk out of the store.
Exactly. But
the reason, I guess, I get you're totally correct in having just literally dealt with home purchase and car purchase. It's terrible because you're a layer removed from that negotiation. You can't talk directly to the seller, and then when you're at the dealership, you can talk directly with the sales guy, but you know they're going to defer to their sales manager, and they're still not going to give you necessarily all the information. You don't know how much the car really invoiced for. You don't know what the market conditions are like. They're telling you that there's scarcity, but you're seeing something different, but the price is still what it is. And
yeah, and even with that, like even if you were to go on like and look at the, you know, the production of what are called durable goods, right? So that's like trucks, cars, washing machines, things like that. What are you going to do? You're going to go line by line and see how many cars were shipped, right? The number of cars produced doesn't equate to the number shipped into an area.
Correct.
So even though, you know, you might have like 1,000 Ford F-150 Lightnings, like that were just shipped, maybe only one of them has gone to your area. So that's part of the game. It's just like, it's hard to know what's going on behind there. So that's when essentially there's this, we talked about this before we got on, there's a sort of this dichotomy, right? This like this interplay between debt and cash, right? And then cash and credit, which is essentially debt.
Debt, different type.
Yeah, you know, slightly different. It's really the same. It's a flavor. It's chocolate versus chocolate chip. So like there's interesting ways that you can look at these two, and right, neither holding 100% either is actually really bad.
Correct.
So a mixture is actually what you ideally want.
As long as it's the right type of mixture.
Correct. Another way of looking at this, like let's go back to that umbrella example, is how do you get people to spend more out in the market, right? The way that you do it is you essentially take away safe things, right? I know that sounds like a weird thing to say, but look at the rates at the Fed, right? Look at what mortgage rates are. Look at all of these essentially debt rates, right? And the reason that they're so low is they're trying to drive people to spend money, right? Because you can gain more that way, right? Suppose the market gives you, and this is a not true statement, but suppose, you know, you can go theoretically in the market and get 25% return, right? You're not going to go to the bank and put your money essentially under a mattress for 0.1% return, right? Theoretically, you know. You're gonna go out and you're gonna do things that are gonna force, that are gonna try to get closer to that 5 to 25%, you know, increase rate. So that's essentially why the rates right now are low, right? When rates are higher, usually the market is going to be probably more volatile. There's gonna be other factors that influence this, right? There's this old saying at the Fed, I say that like I know what's going on there, but which I don't. But I have no idea, to be completely frank. But it essentially says, you know, don't take away the punch bowl too early, right? So there's this trick that economists have to do, and it's this balance between having the market, you know, really, really rev, and having it almost over rev and continuing to essentially keep that punch bowl with, you know, tons of alcohol at this party, and then everybody gets sloppy. That is literally the analogy that is used by economists, which is first off fantastic, because every economist I knew in college could not hold their liquor. So it's just a funny story to me. But in all truth, it's this balance that you need to do between cash and debt.
Yeah, and what I mean by the right mixture is if you have a whole bunch of credit card debt that's, you know, costing you 20%. Probably not a good mixture to have versus a mortgage that's, you know, you're building equity into, you're going to have an asset that appreciates in value and costs you, you know, less than 5%. Then that's something that's worth going after and the right mixture to have versus a whole bunch of credit card debt that you can't pay back. And there's really no way for you to earn 20% on your money at a very consistent basis to match the 20% rate the credit card company is charging you.
Yeah. And with that, there's actually like my favorite historical example, of course, is there's a book that came out a number of years ago, I think it was like 10 years ago, by a French economist, Thomas Piketty, and it was called Capitalism. And what this book said is he went through and he literally looked at like novels from Charles Dickens and like old novels and, you know, old financial records. And he showed, you know, here's what the inflation rate is. Here's what the, you know, the growth curve for capital versus salaries is. And it was like you basically had geometric increase in the amount of, in like the value of capital versus just a linear, you know, so straight line increase of
salaries,
which is why generational wealth is so easy to build if you have it.
Right, and starting from scratch is so difficult, and why everyone feels like they can't buy a house right now.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to pull in the house and car topic and why it relates to what we're talking about here today is another thing that we've talked about in a lot of episodes, and that is the psychology of money.
Yeah.
And, you know, this plays into the FIRE strategies on how you pay off your debts and how you feel like you're accomplishing something as you're paying some of those down. Because the cash that you have has a lot of value in itself. So even if it's inflationary, and even if you say you don't want to have the debt, or you know you're able to pay that cash in, that cash still has a lot of power. Even if you're not earning a lot of interest on it, it still has a lot of power. And so having cash on hand is always beneficial. So that's why we say there's a right mixture to have. You don't want to be all cash, but you don't necessarily want to be all debt. Because if you're all debt, then you obviously don't have any cash to pay it. But if you're all, you know, if you put all your cash into paying off all your debt, then you actually have zero. And so you have this nice asset that's sitting there, but you have no money to do anything with. So if you look at most, I'll just take an analogy here, but, or an example, most companies, say that are publicly traded, if you go through, you know, the Dow 30, you go through the S&P 500, almost all of those companies have enormous amounts of debts. So their balance sheets are huge. Now, they have a ton of assets, and they typically have an enormous stockpile of cash. But they're sitting on enormous piles of debt as well. But because the rates are so low, it pays for these companies to hold on to gobs of debt because they can leverage themselves. A, it makes their financials look better. You get a multiplier effect. Now, if things go south, it's a multiplier effect the wrong way, and so your stock price can get hurt. But
yeah,
that's a more complicated topic for another time. But the basic gist of it is they will keep the debt because they need the cash to run their business. And then they expect the business to generate the money on the cash they put into it at a higher rate than what they pay on the debt. So if the debt costs them, say, we'll just use extreme numbers here, it costs them 10% to pay that back. So they're sitting on $1 billion, it costs them $100 million a year on that debt to pay back. And that is gonna be cash out, but they don't wanna sacrifice the other $900 million. So if they had $1 billion in debt, they have $900 million extra for that end of the year in cash. Well, they can hire salespeople, marketers, administrative people, engineers, etc., to then go and build their business to generate more sales revenue, and say their expectation is to drive a 20% increase in that sales revenue. Well, now they've matched that 10% and they've added another 10% on top of it that they can plow back into their business. So even though they had to pay that $100 million, you know, they made another 10% on top of it. So say they're coming out $200 million ahead, paying off the 100, they get to keep 100, and now they're building off of that. And so while the debt is fixed that they have to pay back, they're building on a bigger base every year as they continue to grow. And if they can continue to outpace the debt payments, they continue to grow at a faster rate and can leverage the cash that they now have on hand. If they didn't have that cash, say they wanted to pay all their debt off at the same time, they would stop growing. Or grow at a much, much slower rate, because they wouldn't have the same amount of cash to hire the same number of people to grow the business at the rate that they were expecting.
A couple things. The first is, that is essentially why you would hear stories for a number of years about how Amazon didn't turn a profit and was losing money.
Essentially, on paper,
right? They would continue leveraging themselves, yep. And they kept building their business, but they were keeping ahead of those debt payments, essentially. So that's essentially one big example. The other thing that's really interesting is something that you implicitly mentioned, and we talked about it a couple minutes ago, is faith in the company. Two examples of this are both Theranos and Enron. So both of them sort of built up this reputation that they were both, you know, reputable companies. And then through one thing or another, they actually ended up being shown that they weren't as reputable, and faith in those two companies was completely shattered. And to some extent actually broke a lot of our trust in markets at that point.
Right. If a company's not a going concern, then the value of the stock, I guess, as it were, the company itself really diminishes quite rapidly.
Yeah, there's also like a bunch of historical examples of this, but yeah, it's basically like once that like faith in the company goes away, just as we talked about with fiat currency, sort of at the end of the Bretton Woods Convention in 1971 when we switched to fiat currency, there's it's do you have faith in this, right? That's a huge part of things. So like that's sort of what I mean about the implicit belief in what is going on with sort of the markets and what we're talking about, with these psychological factors in terms of, rates and sort of how everything holds itself together.
Yeah. So if we come back to personal investments or cash or debt, it's a little bit different, right? You can't pull an Amazon and then just report paper losses, because in the corporate world, cash and profit is not the same thing. So while Amazon was reporting massive losses, negative profits, they were just generating cash like nobody's business, right? They're a cash generating monster, and that's why they've been so successful. And had I really kind of put those pieces together a lot earlier on, I probably would have made a lot more money.
All of us would have.
But if you take it just for your own personal understanding of how you want to go through things, and you take some of those psychological aspects that we've talked through over the last couple of episodes, it starts to really get interesting. And I guess some of it is you're just going to probably do what you want to do. But if you stop to think about what it means to hold your cash versus, instead of actually paying off those good debts, definitely pay off the bad debts. You got a credit card that's, charging you 20%. Yeah. Pay that off. But if you're looking at getting a mortgage, if you're looking at getting a really good car loan, if you're looking at, like, say you're looking at buying a TV because you need one, or a new bed and it's 0% financing or some really favorable terms, you hear the term free money thrown around, but it at some level it is, because time has value and you can assign a dollar value to it. And if you are going through an inflationary period where the money will eventually be worth less, at least having your dollars for your buying power now is better than using all of them up and then not having them later. So for instance, if you had $100,000 in cash and you want to buy $100,000 house, if you put all that $100,000 into the house, you no longer have any cash. So if you need to buy things for your house, if you have something bad that happens, if you have an insurance claim, if you injure yourself, you no longer have the buying power that cash once had, because you have spent all of it on your house. And if you had had that loan that you could work through paying off on a monthly basis, while it's not fun or great to have debt, it does have its purposes and it does bring its values.
Yeah. So branching off of that, one thing you mentioned is insurance. And something that is interesting is that, like, insurance in a lot of places is something that can actually bring your risk down. Right. I know this seems like a super, super tangent, but the modern markets would not necessarily function as they do without insurance, right? Without that reduction of risk. I mean, this even dates back to, like late Middle Ages, early age of exploration.
Listen up, here's another history lesson.
Seriously. So in Lloyd's of London, which is actually one of the largest insurance companies out of the UK, they were essentially a betting service, right? You would go in and you would say, hey, listen, I'm going to, take the ship across the sea. Here's what's in it. Here's my route. And they would basically say, okay, here's how much we're going to essentially bet on this. And that was the beginning of sort of insurance as we know it today. This allowed that exploration across the sea. This allowed, Jamestown and several other, schemes that brought people over to essentially the Americas. One scheme that actually didn't go through this was known as the Darien scheme, which was out of Scotland, and that actually people believe is what led to the union of the crowns in the early 1700s between Scotland and England, basically made one country between the two of them. But because they weren't backed by insurance in the same way, they lost all the profits that the company was putting forwards to try to bring things here. That's why you had the Dutch East India Company, Dutch you know, like you had the, you know, British, it was Hudson's Bay Company was what was in the Americas at one point, the Jamestown Company. You had all these different companies, and that was to assume risk and to kind of spread it out over people. So while we mentioned risk and we mentioned that, you know, you can leverage a lot of different, you know, things to try to mitigate that risk, insurance is actually one of them. And actually one of the first people to quantify, you know, like statistically different hands in poker was actually an economist that was super interested in not only risk, but in insurance. So it's like, so that's another avenue that you could always pursue, because to some extent, life insurance policies are another asset.
Yeah, you actually bring up a good, you bring up a really good point on the, just say the house piece, right? Because a lot of lenders, actually no lender, will lend to you for the house unless you have a homeowner's insurance policy. So without that policy, they won't even give you the debt to have the cash to be able to buy the house.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, cars are similar.
Yeah.
It's not, I mean, it's not completely analogous, right? You don't necessarily need the, you know, the auto owners and, you know, the auto insurance in order to purchase the car, but it's similar, right? And a lot of that has to do with mitigating the risk across, like, into a larger pool. So it brings up a lot of interesting things, right? And so there's, how do you mitigate risk in a larger scale? And one way is to leverage things, right? One way is, and we've talked about this before, is to look at, you know, the beta correlation between different stocks, right? So how, you know, like if this one goes, if the market goes up, this one usually goes down, right? So there's different ways that you can look at risk, and you can look at both debt and cash and see, like, all right, how do I balance these? There's a lot there now that I'm thinking about that. So, whoops.
There is, but it ties a lot, I guess, it ties a lot of what we've talked about through a number of different episodes together. You got your psychology, inflation, deflationary assets, cryptocurrencies, and why their value has has been going up over the last year. How you manage your debt, how you get to a point where you can become financially independent, and while it's not necessarily perfectly in line with that movement, utilizing debt can actually get you to a point where you can become financially independent potentially faster, even though it doesn't perfectly align.
Yeah, I guess kind of building a little bit more off of the psychological aspect that you just mentioned. And at the beginning, we did mention that a small amount of inflation is good. We never explained why. And so actually part of that is psychology, right? So if one of the ways to essentially, you know, like keep workers happy is making sure that inflation goes up a little bit, right? You know, 1-2% a year. And at the same time, you give people a raise of 2-4%. It basically, you know, in terms of real money, does not actually kind of mitigates the increase in pay for that people get, but it allows people to give employers to give everybody a a pay increase every single year.
It also incentivizes you to spend your money and continue pushing the economy forward.
Because exactly.
In a deflationary period, people will withhold their money because it will be worth more tomorrow. So mm-hmm. If you spend it today, you are losing money. Versus in an inflationary period, spending that money today gets you more than it will get you tomorrow. And therefore, if you spend it now, you will have more for the money going forward. And if you can put it into something like a hard asset, it's more valuable. And that's probably why, even though it's a little bit of pandemonium with the house market, the car market, etc., people are willing to shell out exorbitant amounts of money, and almost to the point where they're over leveraging themselves, because they truly, it seems that they believe those prices are going to continue going up. And if they continue going up and they miss that boat, then they're missing the wave. And if they have to buy the house next month, next year, that they'll be paying substantially more than even if they shell out more than asking right now.
Yeah. And as we've talked about before, the best way to kind of like avoid issues with things is planning, and more importantly, keeping a level head, right? Like the best cure to a lot of things is being level-headed and being even-handed about things.
Disciplined.
Yeah. The other thing that is interesting is kind of building off of the example of some of the larger corporations that we've actually mentioned. One thing that you can do actually is create other streams or other, you know, other forms of revenue for yourself, right? And that's another way to sort of mitigate your risk across multiple, you know, essentially, you know, avenues, right? Going back to the poker example, you don't just play one hand, right?
Like, playing everybody's hand.
You're playing everybody's hand. But even more so, you're going to play hand after hand after hand, right?
You didn't go all in on one.
Yeah. So kind of look at life in a similar way in terms of like finances, right? It's a series of hands. And you could also have side bets. I don't recommend doing that at a poker table because that is literally just asking to lose your shirt. But you can do multiple different things at one time. And you can use different strategies, right? If something didn't work once, you know, try a different strategy.
Yeah, we're both firm believers that you have to have multiple streams of income in order to be financially independent or successful. Because even if you do quite well at your job, it's still going to leave you wanting potentially more. And as inflation does keep going up and as we're entering this hyperinflation cycle, so being able to support yourself better to account for it, even though your money may not go as far, diversifying your risk through multiple streams of income, through multiple different types of investments, helps you be able to do that. And then not shelling out all your cash to pay down your debt allows it to be free to be used in other manners that may become necessary.
Absolutely. And as the game Risk always taught me, don't start a land war in Asia. So,
think on that note.
Yep.
Thank you so much for listening. Again, we are Two Halves Make a Whole.
I'm Aaron Blumenthal.
And I'm Mike Cherney. And we will see you in a couple weeks.
Yep.